Our first speaker this morning is Brother Frank Abel of the Shelburne, Ontario Ecclesia in Canada. The theme for Brother Abel's classes this week is the sixth vial. Today's class is entitled The Dragon, the Beast, and the False Prophet. Brother Abel.
Good morning, brothers and sisters. This is obviously the best morning this week to talk about frogs, so we're going to get right into it. Now, Revelation 16, verse 13. That's our verse for this morning. I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. Now, one of the critical things to allow us to advance through this sixth vial is to be able to put some substance to this. What is meant by unclean spirits? What is meant by the frogs? What's meant by the dragon, the beast, the false prophet? And then, of course, out of the mouth of these three areas. Well, I've always found it helpful to, in doing a study, to try to make sure you can look at it from different perspectives. And I'm sure that when brothers and sisters get to discuss prophecy, that very often we, in our view, are excluding other views. When you really look at it and what other people are saying, sometimes you can't allow for what they're saying because you never really looked at it from that point of view. And one of the points of view that we're likely to exclude is the fact that this is definitely talking about the days in which we live and the coming of the Lord. We would take that without any doubt from verse 15. And we're going to be talking about that, especially one day. That's the coming of the Lord. So the sixth vial tells us that at the time of the coming of the Lord, there has to be three powers that you can identify. A dragon power, a beast power, and a false prophet power, where in many cases, when we're coming to this particular verse from history, we're trying to think about who this was way back in the first century or sometime in between. But the prophecy requires that at the time of the coming of the Lord, there is some power somewhere identifiable as the dragon power, as the beast power, and as the false prophet. Now, it would seem to me to be unreasonable not to see any link between what the Bible has said before these represented and what they represent at the time of the Lord's coming. So even though we don't see, say, a Roman power like we saw in the first century through history, we might guess that there is some connection, there is some link between what that dragon power was in the first century, where they actually had dragons as the symbols they carried out into war, as a heraldic symbol, and some power today which is likewise a dragon power. Now, for whatever you might make of other people's exposition, it is interesting that you can open up National Geographic magazine, which I'm sure is not trying to support Christadelphians, and notice that they claim that there is a third Rome today. And it's Moscow. In other words, you don't have to go and say, well, you know, that's John Thomas's view. You can find independent views that will tell you that that power which was once in ancient Rome moved to Istanbul and then went up to Moscow. So if people were just reading National Geographic and they were trying to trace the power of Rome and the influence of Rome in any sense, they couldn't miss that trail, that you go from Rome to Constantinople or Istanbul, and then you go off to Moscow. It would seem to me that the book of Revelation is fairly clear on the beast of the sea. Like in our Daniel exposition, they developed out of the great sea, and they represented powers around it. That when we see the beast of the sea and when we see the beast of the earth, we're going to hardly miss a European power, some power in Europe. And of course, there's been quite a lot written about this, because we do see and have seen in recent years the coming together of the nations of Europe in a way that is most unusual, at least for our times. Some of you have had the opportunity to visit Europe recently. One of the, I think, most notable facts after 1989 and the fall or the disappearance of the Iron Curtain is that if you're Canadian, you can, once you get into Britain, they allow you into that country, getting into France is no problem at all if you're coming from England. It's no problem at all to get into Germany. There isn't even a border. And you can go into Belgium. And you can move freely in a car right across these international borders with no one asking for a passport or anything if you're driving by car in Europe. And you're reading history and you think of how important rivers were and borders were, and today they aren't there because Europe is uniting. And it seems to me that there's something obvious about the fact that what we've been talking about in the middle part of Revelation about a beast is current today in what's happening in Europe. Now, the false prophet, to my mind, and I know that there are, people look at this differently, but I have never, ever been able to see how you could not get the lesson of Daniel 2. Daniel 2, Daniel 7, Daniel 8 tell us, I don't think, with any question, that something that was Roman just after the time of the Greeks, something became Roman. And it continued down into two branches, down into a feet stage. And at the coming of the Lord, which is the same thing, you see, we're looking at Revelation 16, we're saying, well, it's in the period of the coming of the Lord. There has to be a dragon power, a beast power, and a false prophet. And Daniel 2 said, well, there would be. There would be something Roman that would continue right down into the feet. And at the time of the smiting of that image by the Lord Jesus Christ, there would still be the influence of iron mixed with the seed of men. And I just can't help but think that where we live in Canada, that is just so strongly evident, which is largely the subject of what we will talk about tomorrow, but we want to at least mention it today. The idea coming through in Daniel chapter 7, that out of the fourth beast there would be a horn that had many eyes. Well, it is interesting. I don't know whether this is done on purpose or whether it just happens to be a coincidence. If you've ever been standing in St. Peter's Square in Rome and you look at the basilica, the great dome on top of the Vatican, you will see what appears to be little glass enclosures which just look like eyes. I don't know whether that was the intention or not, but it gives you the distinct impression, and I don't think necessarily having written or having read Daniel chapter 7 first, but that this is a seeing building, a building that has windows to see what's going on, which is very typical of Daniel chapter 7, the little horn. And if you remember the article that appeared in Time magazine where we learned, if we didn't know beforehand, of President Reagan and the Pope working together for the overthrow of the political power in Poland, of how the people in the Vatican almost bragged about the fact, look, we've been at this for 2,000 years. Busy in working behind the scenes and trying to control governments. So the idea of eyes, the idea of being everywhere, seeing what's going on and reporting it back to a central base so that there can be some policy formed, is just what's been going on in that organization since its inception. And so I'm going to come and tell you a lot more about this, Lord willing, tomorrow morning, about what I think the modern characteristics of the false prophet are. But for this morning, I just wanted to identify how we're going to look at this, which is no different than what you would find in Eureka. That the dragon power is associated today with Moscow, that the beast power is associated today with Europe, and that the false prophet power today is associated with Rome. Now, it says in Revelation 16, verse 13, that he saw three unclean spirits.
And I believe that understanding what is meant by these unclean spirits is critical in understanding what they're about, what they are representing in today's world. These unclean spirits, verse 14, work miracles. They go forth to the kings of the earth and the whole world to gather them to the battle of that great day of God Almighty. So it's up to us, it should be up to us. We're living in those days to be able to look around and say, well, this is what we think they are. This is where we think they're active. This is what they're up to. This is how they are bringing the nations together for this great battle that God has spoken of through the mouth of his prophets. Now the word, or the phrase, unclean spirit, is clearly related to a number of cases in the scriptures, one of which I want to talk about. We go back to Luke chapter 8. And that's the Bible. That's the Bible that John, Brother John talked about last night. That you can see the links. You know, he uses a phrase. Well, if you know what the Bible says, you can see that phrase as it's being developed and introduced and talked about in other cases. And in Luke chapter 8, there is, I think, the standout account of Legion. You remember the chap that said his name was Legion. It says in verse 26, they arrived at the country of the Gadarenes, which is over against Galilee. And when he went forth to land, there met him out of the city a certain man which had devils long time, and wore no clothes, neither abode in any house, but in the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell down before him with a loud voice, said, what have I to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of God Most High? I beseech thee, torment me not. For he had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man. For oftentimes it had caught him, and he was kept bound with chains and in fetters. And he brake the bands and was driven of the devil into the wilderness. And Jesus asked him, saying, what is thy name? And he said, Legion, because many devils were entered into him. Now, without necessarily going on to all the detail, that's sufficient, I believe, to describe what this man was like. Now, you ask yourself, we ought to ask ourselves this, why is that detail given? What does it matter that this man dwelt in the tombs? What does it matter that this man had great strength so that even though he was bound, he could break the chains? Why are these details there, except that when we come to the book of Revelation and we see there's unclean spirits, we're supposed to think of this. What is the characteristic of an unclean spirit? Well, it seems to me, and I just wish now I had made an overhead or a transparency of this to illustrate these things, there's 10 characteristics that I'd like you to think of when you think of this, the way we're going to follow this through. If you want to just make a note of these as we go through, because I think it would be important to come back later on and see how these characteristics apply so often to things in our particular time and in our experience. The first thing is, this man had some kind of an idea of the truth, maybe even a clearer idea than the sober people around him, because there weren't many sober people that were saying, thou art Jesus, the Son of God, the Son of God the Most High. Now here's a man who has what it says is an unclean spirit, but he recognizes that Jesus is the Son of God. So there is truth associated with this man. But he was also a man who said his name was Legion. So there was insanity. There was, if you like, there was error associated with this man. So it was part truth and part error that was coming out of his mouth. This man could do wonders. There wasn't any average man that could just take, who was bound by chains and break them. This man, with his insanity, had great strength, not unlike certain diseases that we know, mental diseases that people can have, where they seem to possess great strength. So he was able to do wonders, but not productively. That's the third point. He was able to do wonders, but there was nothing good about it, so he could break chains. It doesn't appear that he was ever used in that capacity anywhere, because this man was untamable. No one can manage him. Untamable. He was of no use to people. And number four, he knew no shame. He wandered around naked. There was no shame associated with his lifestyle. You start to think, hey, that's getting pretty close to today's society. You just start linking these things to what you know about today's society. We just had a big gay pride parade in Toronto. And I think, boy, is there ever a case for people today to have no shame? And that's exactly what God said in Ezekiel 16 when he talked about this was the sin of Sodom. The very last thing that the Sodomites did before which God judged them was they displayed their wares. They were haughty. They paraded what they believed, what they stood for, and that's society today. So, there was no shame associated with this man. He was scary. In other words, it was something to put fear in other people. People didn't pass by that way because this man was terrifying. Number six, this man had a multiple personality. He said, we're legion. He had a great deal of insanity, if you like. There were many aspects to it. The way of life that this man had was inflicting harm upon himself. It says he cut himself with stones. It says he was dwelling with death. His dwelling place was not in a home, but in the tombs. So he was every day dwelling with death. And I did mention already, but point number nine would be the fact that he was not manageable. No man could tame him. There was nothing useful or productive about his life. And then number 10, with Jesus' intervention, we find the man later on in the chapter sitting clothed and in his right mind. So it represented a society, I believe, that was unmanageable, that only the Lord himself could deal with by intervening. Now you take that as the characteristics of unclean spirits and then come back to Revelation. It says in just as a couple modifiers here, if you have a look at Ephesians chapter 6, one of the things that we've been told and forewarned about the warfare that we must carry on is given to us in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12. And it says, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. What our problem is dealing with the philosophies of life and their subtle outworkings in all of the areas which we encounter in today's world. If there was a particular person who was our enemy, we could be wary of him. We could avoid him. We'd know where he was and how we could deal with him. But we're wrestling against ideas, philosophies, the teachings of men, primarily coming out in the religion today of humanism, where human values are elevated way above God's values. And it's subtle. It's sometimes hard to recognize these things. That's the warfare that we must fight. And so, just in the reading we did this morning in 1 John chapter 4, verse 1, our object is, as he says, believe not every spirit, but try the spirits, whether they are of God, because many false prophets are gone out into the world. Now that's our work. God's given that to us. Not to be gullible about this, not to be naive and to think that, you know, everything we hear, there's good in it. Well, there may be a little good because, you know, Legion did recognize who the Lord was. There's an element of truth in it, but that's just a way to recognize it. There's also an element of error. There's an element of a multiplicity of insanity or different ways in which we can see the insanity of it. Now let's, before we put this together, come to the part about frogs. Now, before we get into where John Thomas leads us in frogs, it is an interesting thing. If you're living on a farm, you do get to know quite a bit about frogs. We have a pond just beside the house. And there's two things I would say are characteristics of the frog that you know of that stand out about the rest and almost are unique characteristics of a frog. One is a frog goes through a metamorphosis. Now, there's very few animals, very few creatures that we know of that do that, that go through a metamorphosis. You first see a frog, you see a cluster of eggs, probably around a bulrush root or something in the pond. Next thing you see, just a swarm of little black bodies with a tail wiggling themselves around the pond. And then, of course, if you watch it closely, you see the formation of the legs, the disappearance of the tail, and then finally these things coming out onto land. So it's an interesting animal. It's characterized by a metamorphosis. It goes through stages of its lifestyle and its life cycle. The second thing is, it's not easy to see a frog. You have to look closely because they're camouflaged, in very case, very wonderfully camouflaged. But you can always tell a frog and where a frog is because they can't keep their mouth shut. Now, isn't that interesting, though? I mean, God's given us these characteristics of this little creature. With its mouth open, you know there's a frog there. You might not be able to see it, but you can tell it by what it's saying. So quite apart from looking historically at who frogs might represent, those are two characteristics which really help us. The frog goes through a metamorphosis. It goes through stages in its development. And it's got a big mouth. And you can tell where it is by what it's saying, by where and its loudness. Now, one of the things that Brother Paul and I had in mind to do was try to find the tapestry, I think I mentioned this to you earlier, that John Thomas mentions in Elpis, Israel, that was in the cathedral at Reims in France. This cathedral, according to his exposition, contained tapestry which shows that the early kings of France had on their heraldic symbols, on their shields, the symbol of a frog. So that he was then able to show that the frog in Revelation is telling us about the nation of the French. And I just found so much evidence for this, quite apart from the cathedral at Reims, and we'll talk about that in a minute. I work with a person who is very, very much into the French language and trying to preserve the French culture. And I didn't really ask him any questions, but I just happened to catch him in his conversation likening the French to a frog. And I thought, well, you know, that's just about the most independent kind of support you can get for this idea. Not that that's the only thing, because there's much written in literature all the time identifying French with the frogs. I have several cuttings with me. I don't have overheads of them, but several cuttings out of magazines recently where the French have been associated with a frog. You may remember when the French were doing their testing recently of atomic weapons against world opinion. And it shows a picture of Chirac drinking a cup to celebrate his victory of doing this testing against world opinion. And on the table, they got a salt shaker and a pepper shaker, and they're frogs. Now, I'm sure they weren't just didn't happen to be frogs, except it was appropriate to put the symbol of a frog in the picture with the French. So this is of long standing. It's not something that's twisted or distorted. So we went to have a look at these frogs, if we could find them in Reims. And it was pretty well a long shot on our part. We didn't have much time to stop at Reims, or didn't even know if we were going to stop at Reims. But this idea of frogs, unclean spirits like frogs, they are the spirits of demons doing signs which are going forth to the kings of the whole habitable earth, are just too intriguing. You just want to find everything you can about them to see if you can expand this a little more. Now, this is what John Thomas had, and this is taken largely from Elpis, Israel. This is what he had showed us. Symbol of French democratic nation. He goes back to the medal of a frog of Childeric, king of the French, back in A.D. 456. And he showed that it was on the banner of Clovis, it was on the shield of Clovis, that the frogs were clearly identifiable. So I thought, well, that's pretty good evidence. Anyway, we went to this particular cathedral to see if we could find this evidence, and I must have left my picture of it anyway. The way this worked out was really quite interesting. We had no idea where this cathedral was, and sometimes these old, old buildings are in repair and you can't even get into them, or they don't open to a certain time. But when we got to this cathedral at Reims, this is one huge building. And it's no wonder it's been awe-inspiring to people, because it is essentially hollow. And how they ever managed to build this when they did and put all the fixtures into it becomes a bit of an engineering marvel. But getting inside, as it is in almost everywhere we went in these cathedrals, is dimly lighted. You never see anything too clear. I don't know whether because you would see the cracks in the building and want to get out of there or what. But you just see a little. It's kind of spooky. And you know what we've said about light, so you take it from there. But we came in the door of this cathedral, and we're just turning the door, and guess what we saw? Now, if you've read the Bible magazine, you know that, because it tells you what we saw. Here we are trying to find this tapestry, and coming in the door, here is this big banner facing us. The 1500th anniversary of Clovis's baptism, and there's a picture of him with three frogs on a shield. Walk in the door. I mean, it couldn't have been better if it had been prearranged by everybody working on it. There, if we didn't see anything else, we had seen what we came to find. A picture illustrating the French and the frog going back to these times, just a few hundred years just a couple hundred years after the first century. So we did a little asking around, and found out that there was another building you could go into to actually see this tapestry. Now, I don't know, this is really a work of art. I mean, you think of how these people did this going back to these days. There was a room that had a display of all kinds of these tapestries. They're like huge carpets. The one we looked at must have been, I would say, 30 feet long, 20 feet high. And this is what we saw on it, which illustrates that the picture is very complex, but nevertheless the evidence is obvious. Very colorful. Now that's from a photo in the building. And this must have been one of maybe 20 or 30 tapestries that were found all around this display area of different stages of the development of the French in their early years. And what I was interested in was not only, you know, the obvious frogs, which are there, but if you look close enough, you saw tadpoles. And it would seem to me that the French had caught up the idea of a metamorphosis as well, that there was something unusual about this animal. It wasn't just the fact of, you know, they were in a marshy area, but they maybe saw something in a metamorphosis of it. And of course, that's the whole point that we see in Revelation 16, is the metamorphosis. There was once a monarchy. There was once a very close-held religious system governing the people of France and a nobility. But it was torn away by what happened to the nation and completely turned into, as we might say, the metamorphosis of an adult frog, which now has, in its croaking, in its message that it sent out to the nations around, it's got the whole of Europe in an uproar. So the spirit of democracy has spread throughout the whole area. And I believe that's exactly what Revelation chapter 16 is telling us. Now, look a little further, because it did mention that it's not that simple. It's not that you can just say, well, there you are, you see, there was a French Revolution, and people got this idea of, well, let's overthrow our king, let's overthrow the system of government. No, we fight against philosophies. We don't fight against people in that sense. Our warfare is to deal with this, and this is what overcame the French. Now, I've said out of the mouth of the French, because these are only people that were French. There were certainly people in France that were saying other things. I have deliberately chosen these people to represent the kind of things that I believe that the frog spirit established in motion and which has continued ever since. Now, you look at the dates of these people. René Descartes, 1596 to 1650. Well, the French Revolution is 1789, so you're looking at 100 years. This
this man's philosophy would have been out there, and the French would have understood it. What did he say? Well, he searched without success for the human soul, so he said that man was merely a mechanism. Where have you heard that before? I mean, isn't that part of the philosophy that we wrestle with today? People have discounted the Holy Scriptures, and they've elevated the idea that, you know, you've just got to support men, because men will solve their problems if they have sufficient time. Yeah, people have just walked away from religion, but it was these characters that led it. And when he's pointing the finger at the French, it's not because the French people and the blood that goes through them is different than us. It's this kind of philosophy that started it off. Jean Rousseau. Now look, when he died, 1778, and the revolution was the next year. So his philosophy would have really, I think, elevated the thinking of the people to deny the biblical fall of man, and as he said, think of men as having an inherent goodness. Now that's what we wrestle with today. You go and pick up a book in a bookstore of how to raise your kids, and they'll tell you, look, the kid's basically good. What you want to do is you want to try to get that good to develop. And because he doesn't develop like you, don't worry about it, because he's basically good. And don't impose upon him a religion. Let him develop his religion. You read it. It's right in the bookstores of how to raise kids today. And I think it's directly linked to the philosophy of Jean Rousseau. If he was the first, he probably wasn't the first. But he was a person who was very influential in the time of the French Revolution. And you get that out of books like Encyclopedia Britannica. You don't have to listen to me. That's generally understood. Francois Voltaire mocked the Roman Church to the extent that he was exiled to England. But there was a lot to mock. It wasn't that he didn't have anything to say that was legitimate. There was lots of things to say that were legitimate. So people got on the bandwagon because they could see the mockery too. But he also mocked the monarchy. And we know that when the people rose up, they were ready to take on not just the church, but overthrow the whole regime. Look when he died, 1778, a year before the revolution. Comte de Buffon, now he was a person, as people would say, without any axe to grind, this was a man who prepared the ground for Charles Darwin. So once you throw the Bible out, once you bring in that man's inherently good, then you can see how Darwin's ideas could very easily take root. We don't need the Bible to explain this. You know, you give a situation for something to develop and allow it to develop, and we have another idea altogether as to how we came about. Look when he died, 1788. So we're looking at, we're looking at people here I think I said a year before the revolution. Obviously, it wasn't a year before, because we're looking at 89. This is the man who died a year before the revolution. Now, Jean Lamarck was a person who took up ideas about evolution, say, based on Buffon's idea. But his idea was that, you know, people aren't using their legs the way they used to. So you can well imagine in time people are not going to have legs. If he ever saw the people working on computers, I wonder what he would have said. People are working so long on computers, they're going to have huge hands and fingers. They're going to have swelled heads, but they're not going to have any legs. You know, I don't know whether people really, really believe that, but this man's philosophy, Jean Lamarck, survived into the 50s, into 1950s in the Soviet Union, where they still believed that that was the basis upon which evolution occurred. That if you didn't do things in your life, or if you did certain things in your life, you could influence your offspring. Now, there was a man around called Gregory Mendel. I don't know, some of you, if you've gone back to your biology days, would know about it, the science days, where you've heard about Gregory Mendel. His research showed that was totally wrong and impossible, but no one listened to him, because this was what was current, and this is what people wanted to believe, and this was supporting the ideas of the revolution, and that's exactly the way it works today. When you see what professors publish in this country or any other country, it's what supports the case that they're trying to make. And there is very, very, very few people who really are looking for truth. The truth is found in God's Word. So these are the kinds of things I believe that we look at when we look at what really made the revolution work. Well, people's ideas about God were so shot through by these philosophers that this idea of Francois Voltaire in his ability to mock and mock legitimately the Roman Church was so, you know, felt widespread, and people got behind that, that it was quite obvious. God was out of the picture altogether, and the people were able to do what they did, and I suppose in some cases with what they thought was a free conscience. Now, you take that pattern, brothers and sisters, the pattern of the insanity of Legion, 10 points. You look at the idea that really what we're supposed to be looking for is the ideas and the philosophies of men. And I've only looked at a few, and I'm sure that some of you out there would probably know a lot more about this and how you can put a pattern together. But those seem to me to be the ones that rocked the French nation such that we're able to throw off the monarchy and democracy was able to develop. Now, I didn't get a chance to do this, but I tell you, there's a lot of evidence around for looking at public opinion. There's a whole section in encyclopedias, if you look for it, on public opinion and how it has grown, and how during the French Revolution, public opinion became so important that they couldn't understand it, how, you know, people were getting to know things and get on the bandwagon and then become very powerful behind it. You think, well, what's different today? How do people get elected but except that they know what the public opinion is? And with public opinion polls, they change their policies so that we're almost being directed by the spirit of the French Revolution, which is, what is the opinion of the masses? What are the people saying? How are the frogs croaking? And accordingly, we'll be governed. And the idea of a monarchy, the idea of being governed by the moral principles of the Bible are just gone by the way. That's the world we live in. So when I showed you this picture yesterday, you may be able to see it in a slightly different light today. Now, what's characteristic about this that makes it madness is, first of all, it's part true. That when you mix the truth and the error together, it's hard to determine what to follow. So here out of this man Legion, he knows who Jesus Christ is, when other people with all their marbles didn't know who he was. But the man still says he's Legion. He thinks he's multiple. There's many people in him, and his life is useless. And so this man has taken the scriptures, driven by the fact of, I think, obviously, with the amount of writing he has done without proper assessment of the scriptures, seems to be far more impressed in impressing people. Whether it is to make money in selling books, I don't know, but to impress people and to provide leadership without taking due consideration of, say, James chapter 3, be you not many teachers, would seem to me to be just part of what we would call the madness of that kind of thing. Now look at how this can go, brothers and sisters, and I must say that with the imagination of people in being able to see how this theme really goes through society, you could take it far further than I have. That's madness. Isn't it interesting that when they first tested atomic bombs and they were developing this thing, and the race was on to get the super bomb, that they called it mutual assured destruction. They called it mad. The philosophy behind developing nuclear weapons was that we will get weapons so strong that the enemy won't dare to use them, because if we use them, we'd all go down. No one will survive that kind of a war. And that was the philosophy upon which these things developed, which the rest of the world says, do we need weapons that could kill us 10 times over? Now, the weapons are still here. We're living in a society that is possessed by weapons, which the philosophy is mutual assured destruction. You send one over, we'll send one back, or two. And away it goes. And there's articles written in Scientific American about whether you could really ever argue a limited nuclear war. Like, would it ever be limited that someone would lob one across and you lob one back and say, okay, let's shake hands, it's enough. Well, that's the kind of world we live in. That's what we would expect to live in. This is the time of the unclean spirits that are driven by public opinion, that God has If you say, sort of allowed men to develop in areas where before, he said, I'm going to change their languages. Because what they imagine to do, I will never be able to achieve my purpose with them. But now, see, languages are not a big barrier. And nations are working together. You think of this space station they're developing. It's just another area of madness. I think it's important to even think of where this came from. I don't know whether you can read that. I'll try to read that to you. I can't see it too well myself. But it says, history changed on October 6, 1957, when the former Soviet Union successfully launched Sputnik 1. The world's first artificial satellite was about the size of a basketball, weighed only 183 pounds, and took about 98 minutes to orbit the Earth on its elliptical path. That launch ushered in new political, military, technological, and scientific developments. While the Sputnik launch was a single event, it marked the start of the space age and the USSR space race. The Sputnik launch also led directly to the creation of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, in July 1950. Congress passed the Space Act, which created NASA as of October 1, 1958. And you know what they're trying to do. The Mir space station is doomed. They know it's going to come back to the Earth and burn up. They hope not in one piece. They're going to try internationally with a number of nations to reestablish another space station where they can carry on their activities, maybe thinking that one day they will really investigate whether there is water on the moon and go again and have people walking on the moon. But from our point of view, brothers and sisters, we know the Bible tells us clearly the earth is what God has given to the children of men. The heavens are Yahweh's. He never promised us anything other than this planet. For people to spend billions of dollars and to get caught up in this is pure madness. But based on public opinion and based on the fact that people have taken God out of their life and see that, hey, this may be the only way of saving life on this planet, you can see how people are fully bent in going in that direction. There is just one passage I'd like to bring to your attention at this time, brothers and sisters. It's one that we don't spend enough time on, back in Joel. I intend to try to do this tomorrow, is to take up the idea with you of what we can get, something like what we did with the unclean spirit, of looking at all the passages that speak about the coming of the Lord and trying to put together a list of things which would characterize the gathering together of the nations. And I think we can do it. One of them is this. In Joel 3, verse 9, it says, proclaim you this among the Gentiles. Prepare war. Wake up the mighty men. Let all the men of war draw near. Let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords, your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, I am strong. Assemble yourselves and come, all you nations. Gather yourselves together round about. Thither cause thy mighty ones to come down, O Yahweh. So it would seem to me clear from Joel chapter 3, that in the gathering together of the nations, there is a great preparation for war. Well, look at what we find. And I mean, this is really impressive when you look at our society. This was not true. It's not just nuclear weapons. You look at this. This is 1996. The top military budgets of the nations of the world, the U.S. of A. is $265 billion. The next nation is Russia at $50 billion. One of the ironies of this is it's in the name of peace. And you know how it would seem, on one hand, when you look at this, you seem to see the truth of it, in that the United States has put billions of dollars into various nations to try to get stability, preparing to buy nuclear waste from the Soviet Union in order to keep it from spreading to other nations, and willing to buy, you would say, into nations to stop them from developing nuclear weapons, as they would in Korea. But at the same time, the greatest nation as an arms broker in the world is the United States. That is, they're selling weapons to nations around the world. It is total madness to think that you will get peace by arming everybody to the teeth. So we want peace here? Well, get your gun on the way out, brothers and sisters. Next time we have a little dispute over lunch, well... Top military budgets of the nations. I mean, that is astounding when you think of how much money. But then again, when you think of what it costs for one aircraft, one battleship, one aircraft carrier, one missile, and you think of the way they fight today, it is most interesting to contemplate, let the weak say, I am strong. Just to illustrate that point. Now, that's madness. You might not get all of this off this overhead. It took me quite a while to put this together. I got this off the internet in a different way and tried to put it on a graph so you could see what it means. You do know that what is described as a poor man's atomic bomb is biological weapons or chemical weapons. Well, they used to use nerve gas. And in terms of the millions of deaths, we would say that nerve gas would kill up to, say, a million people. We're looking at 1 kilogram of it, lethal dose per kilogram. So 1 kilogram of nerve gas would kill a million people. Well, 1 kilogram of botulism toxin would kill, say, 10 million people. When you go into this anthrax spore slurry, it's now 100 million people. Well, it's not long when you go up this way that you come to a billion people and then the present Earth's population. But now we're looking at 1 kilogram of this particular material called a bacteria powder can kill millions of billions or of millions. So you here you have an overkill of maybe 10, 20, maybe 100 million times the Earth's population. 1 kilogram. That's madness. And if a little nation that's weak has 1 kilogram of that material, they're strong. You see, there's a uniqueness of that phrase to our society that never applied anywhere before. You might say, well, a little person, even a kid, as we've seen in some of these school incidents, a kid with a gun is a tremendous weapon in terms of what he can do and the damage he can do. But when you think of killing a million people, or 100 million people, as the case may be, with just 1 kilogram of material, it shows you how mad it's got. Who needs to kill everybody over 100 million times or something? It's stupid what's going on in the world today. But these weapons continue to develop. Now, I know we're just out of time here, but I'd like to show you this one before I leave. The Samson option. The Samson option is Israel's way of looking at what happens if they meet doomsday. This is a sign that you would run into if you were traveling along the road that goes by the Dead Sea. It shows Dimona, which is their nuclear resource area, Eilat, which is, of course, in the south part of Israel. We know Beersheba, and Sidon or Sodom. I just think that's a wonderful combination of words for Christadelphians to think, and it's on a signpost in Israel. The Samson option that the Israelis almost used was in 1973. These are taken right out of this book, The Samson Option, from Random House. Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Dayan, for one, thought it was all over. This is the end of the Third Temple, he said. The situation is desperate. Everything is lost. We must withdraw. On Monday, October 8, 1973, Israel called it its first nuclear alert and began aiming its modern doomsday weapons. The Samson Option. We got to go. We'll take everybody with us. And you know what happened? The Russians spotted them preparing their weapons. And the Russians started to react. And the Americans saw the Russians preparing for this particular reaction. And they established a red alert. You may remember that time in 73 in that war. It was probably the closest case we've ever got to nuclear war because of the madness of the Samson option. It comes to people going to take over Israel, we'll take them down with nuclear weapons. Who knows how many they had or just what they intended to do. That's today's world, brothers and sisters. They're unclean spirits like frogs, people who got others to think other than on the scriptures and about God, and has taken society down a route where the only person that can help us is the Lord Jesus Christ. When he appears on the scene, Satan sits clothed and in his right mind.